From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. In Evanston, Illinois, city council officials are set to soon vote on a $10 million plan to use marijuana tax money for a reparations program. It's intended to make amends for past racist housing practices. If approved, Evanston is said to be the first U.S. city to use marijuana revenue to fund reparations for black residents. As Evanston City Council members prepare to vote, some in the community are objecting to the plan, saying it doesn't go far enough. The Evanston vote occurs amid a long nationwide debate over financial reparations to black Americans. They were promised land in 1865 after the Civil War, but although black Americans helped build our country's wealth, President Andrew Johnson overturned the land rule, and since then, black Americans have endured Jim Crow, redlining, and even the racist destruction of black communities and economic centers, such as those in Springfield, Illinois, and Tulsa, Oklahoma. Last month, a congressional committee took testimony on legislation to study the idea of reparations 30 years after it was first proposed. Joining us today to talk about the plan for reparations in Evanston is Robin Sue Simmons, who's a co-sponsor of the legislation there and alderwoman of Evanston's 5th Ward. Alderwoman Simmons, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for the invitation. And it's Alderman Robin Rue Simmons.
Oh, my apologies, Alderman Simmons. Joining us today is Evanston historian Dino Robinson, who is the founder of Shorefront Legacy Center in Evanston, which collects, preserves, and educates people about local black history. He wrote a 70-page report documenting racist and discriminatory practices in Evanston dating to the late 1800s. Thank you for being here, Dino, as well.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Also with us is Alvin Tillery. He is director of the Center for the Study of Diversity and Democracy and professor of political science at Northwestern University. As the Evanston City Council debated on this issue, Professor Tillery gave them two training sessions and attended one of the community meetings that Alderman Simmons organized as part of her efforts to garner support for the proposal. Alvin, thank you for joining us today as well.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, would you support your community trying to make amends for things like slavery, Jim Crow, redlining? What form should that compensation take? You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. And Alvin, I'd like to begin with you. Before we get into the specifics of what Evanston is doing, let's take a step back and look at the big picture here. This discussion of reparations, as I mentioned, it's been ongoing and disputed in the U.S. since slavery was abolished in 1865, or at least supposedly abolished. Originally, from my understanding, reparations were proposed to make amends for slavery and the exclusion of black Americans from accruing the wealth that was built from their labor. Can you talk about this history in general and specifically how the concept of reparations was interpreted then and how it's understood today?
Sure, Brian. I mean, I think this is a really important point that you're making, that there's a very deep history here. Actually, the concept of reparations is even older than the end of slavery in the U.S. You had slaves who had obtained freedom in the United States suing former masters for compensation and pensions as early as the 18th century. There's a famous case of Belinda Royal in 1783, who actually won some sort of compensation. And so the notion of reparations for a great moral evil or harm like slavery is really foundationally in the root of Anglo-American and Western jurisprudence. And so, you know, it was just natural for politicians who wanted to integrate blacks into the country at the end of the Civil War, the radical Republicans, people like Charles Sumner, et cetera, to sort of think about monetary compensation for all of the crimes of slavery. And we also know about special orders, field orders number 15, that tried to compensate black Americans with 40 acres and a mule in South Carolina and other Gulf areas. And we know that Andrew Johnson reversed that, as you said in your introductory remarks.
Alderman Simmons, can you explain then how the goal of the or what is the goal of the reparations resolution that you co-sponsored?
Well, first, I want to make a correction and let you know that it was in November of 2019 that we did pass Resolution 126R19, restricting the first $10 million of cannabis sales tax to fund reparations. So we passed that legislation in 2019 after several years of public participation and legislative process. So we are advancing our first remedy proposal is what is the vote on March 22nd. And our case for local reparations in Evanston is much different than the specific cases for HR 40 and what other communities might pursue. Our case, one, was informed by the community on where our harm is, and it was backed up by a robust report created by Dino Robinson and his team on housing policy, anti-Black housing policy in action, specifically of course in Evanston, which stripped away generational wealth in the Black community. So our goal is to bring redress, repair specifically in the area of injury in our case for reparations, and that's in housing. And it's named in our resolution 126R19, if you'd like to learn more about that. So our goal is to restore wealth that had been stripped away in the Black community and empower the Black community. Now, full repair is something that as a Black community, we would love to see, but we're real clear on there are many accomplices in the United States and even in Evanston to the racial gap and the racial disparities. And we're taking an incremental but urgent step towards repair in line with the practices enforced by the city of Evanston. And the first initiative is a $25,000 direct benefit, $50,000 per household. And that certainly is a way to immediately bring back wealth to a family that could be used for equity, can be used for various ways to strengthen wealth and to strengthen a family. So our goal is simply to build wealth, to restore the Black community, to empower the Black community, invite those that have left Evanston because of a lack of affordability or lack of a sense of place, and lift up the Black community in a tangible way beyond ceremony, beyond apology, in a way that will head us in the right direction towards repair and redress. And I also want to say that we know that this is only the first step, not nearly enough, but clear that we alone, sure, as one municipality cannot account for the egregious crimes against the Black community in Evanston. And that's why we look forward to HR 40 passing and have been in support by resolution since 2002 of HR 40.
All right, Alderman Simmons, thank you for correcting me on the timeline earlier there. And I hear you sort of already addressing the some of the objections that some have expressed to this not going far enough. And I want to ask you to put a pin in that, and we're going to come back to that aspect of the conversation in a little bit. Dino Robinson, if I can bring you into the conversation now, can you talk about specifically Evanston's history with redlining? You know, these reparations are intended specifically to make amends for past racist housing practices. Maybe you can even start with a definition of redlining for some of our listeners who might not be familiar.
Sure. Redlining within Evanston, and I think with the rest of the nation, the federal government participated in sponsoring a study in urban development, and they developed a series of mapping, HOPE maps, the housing authority. I can't remember the exact title right now, but I refer to it as the Hulk map. And this included some diagrams of where residential areas are desirable and those that are not desirable. They're color coded and they're number coded and letter coded as well. So A, B, C, and D. D being the lowest, A being the highest. Then you have color coded: green, yellow, blue, and red. And the undesired areas were always colored in red, thus redlining. In Evanston specifically, when we were looking at this study, we noticed that over time when the Evanston's one particular ward where most of the Black residents were being pushed into early in the in the 19th century, the Hope Map redlined area directly overlaid the Fifth Ward. And the further direction with that informed banks and real estate agencies not to invest in those properties, in those areas. So when a family living in a red area, banks are instructed or advised not to fund in those areas. Development is ill-advised to develop in those areas. Real estate agents would then target those areas for a specific group of people to live in that area. And so that's kind of like the gist of redlining. And Evanston played a part in that. It wasn't codified as a direct law with specific verbiage that said only Blacks can live in certain areas, but they use coded context with that, with the adoption of Jim Crow without actually putting it on the books, but adopting that as a way of life in Evanston. And then passing some ordinances and other type of things that would use coded language like land clearance, where they would identify areas that they would consider blighted, i.e. would read Black communities that are scattered throughout Evanston and use the land clearance ordinance to remove the Black families there for new development and then only allow them to live in certain areas of Evanston. And that played out through the history of the city of Evanston. And some of it we can date back to as early as 1919.
And how does that legacy affect Black residents in Evanston today?
So there's a number of layers with that. So the report I put together, though the initial impetus was to focus on housing and housing disparities in Evanston, we want to look at an overall cultural and social environment in Evanston. So if you look at what's happening today, especially with development, you can see how redlining almost set permanently an issue with how we view certain areas of Evanston. So over the decades, you've had the senses of this area is not, the target area is not the area to live in. So we will not invest in that. We'll not spend time in that area. And recently in the, 2008, there was a online blog where a person posted on there that I'm thinking of moving to Evanston. Where should I live? And a few days later, another respondent posted a map of Evanston and hand drew boxes on that map indicating where great places to live, but then one box with a big X through it with no. And if you look at that area and overlay it with where the Fifth Ward is and overlay that with the red line area, it all overlays on top of each other. So over the course of decades and generations, you have this preconceived notion of what is desirable and what is not desirable, what is worth investing in, what is not worth investing in. And that has impacted the African-American community over the course of time with these type of actions. So you have, employment issues, school, housing, zoning practices, policing, all these play a part in the issues that address the African-American community today.
Wow, you don't even, as you said, with a Facebook person posting that map on Facebook, you don't even have to work that hard to make the mental connections between the past and the present with that. We need to take a break here in just a couple of minutes, but Professor Alvin Tillery, before we do, when we were inviting you to come on the show, you mentioned that you provided the Evanston City Council with a couple of training sessions. Can you talk about what you covered in those sessions in their run-up to this policy?
Sure. I mean, I don't know that I gave them anything that Alderman Simmons didn't already know or some of the other aldermen. But what I really tried to stress is the kind of role that government action played in all of these inequalities that Dino so eloquently described happening in Evanston, and how it's really a national story. And what I tried to urge them to think about is developing programs that were going to be tightly tailored to provide solutions to the actual harms that were created, right? Because I was thinking a lot about sustainability and the very conservative legal jurisprudence that we have around race in America. My concern was that, if you didn't sort of identify the crime, or the harms, explicitly and make the programs directly reflective of you know, what had been done, that they might face challenges. But it's clear to me that the work that Alderman Simmons and others in the community have done really did take up that charge. And this seems to be a program that is very narrowly tailored to reflect the immediacy of the harms that the city and other actors played in creating a racially segregated, underdeveloped Fifth Ward.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation. We need to take a short break. Listeners, if you want to join us, the number to call is 800-222-9455. Would you like to see something like this in your own community? 800-222-9455 is the number. More to come here on the 21st after a short break. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the city of Evanston's efforts to redress past racist housing practices through reparations, providing housing support for current Black residents of the community there. We are talking about this with Alderman Robin Rue Simmons, who is a Fifth Ward alderman in Evanston. Also, Dino Robinson, a historian who wrote a long report documenting the racist and discriminatory housing practices in Evanston. And Professor Alvin Tillery, who is a associate professor of political science at Northwestern University. And I want to share, we solicited a voicemail from Sebastian Knowles, who is one of the organizers of a group called Reject Racist Reparations. He's a former mayoral candidate in Evanston, and he recrapped the proposal and then detailed his group's objections. Let's take a listen.
All Black residents of Evanston have been exposed to racism and are owed repair. But creators of the program say the limited impact of the current proposal is because of the size of the fund. However, this only reinforces our claim that the proposed program is incomplete and deserves more community involvement. The lack of community input has resulted in a reparations plan that would be detrimental to Black residents and the larger movement. I've spent the last 6 months of my candidacy advocating for the expansion of the current program to lay out a plan going forward. And the residents who came to me worried about this program are the ones who make up our organization. There is no plan going forward on the remaining $9.6 million. We are asking the City Council to either change the name of the bill, as it does not fall under the definition of reparations, or that they allow the next City Council to expand and vote on a complete program in May, which is overwhelmingly supported by candidates running for office. All of us want and support reparations, but we want it done in a way that will positively change Black lives in Evanston.
Okay, it sounds to me like one of the key objections there is the idea of using new tax money from marijuana sales is not reparations. Reparations would be about taking generations of wealth that was stolen from Black Americans and redistributing it in a way that begins to redress those past harms. Alderman Simmons, do you have a response to Sebastian Knowles's statement? What are your thoughts on, I don't know, changing the name of the bill, removing the word reparations, as he's suggested?
I do have a response to Sebastian's statement. I didn't hear at all what you heard, but I will say that we are encouraged that there has been more interest and voices to join the reparations discussion. Sebastian was one of two losing candidates against our mayor-elect, who won with 73% of the vote, running in support of the direction that we're going with reparations now, a candidate with significant legislative experience. But I can say that in support of what Sebastian is saying, that it is not enough, that it is insufficient. But it is the first tangible step to redress, to not advance our program when we have funding, when we have a policy that is passed, and we have a very thoughtful, coherent, tangible, actionable, implementable program that many residents are excited for and grateful for the opportunity to receive $25,000 direct benefit to restore and build wealth for their families that they otherwise did not have access to. And in terms of more community engagement and a longer process, as I stated, we passed this in 2019 in November after an initial introduction in February of 2019. So there is no reason to delay. We can see in our data that in Evanston, we have a $46,000 household income divide between Black and white Evanston. We have an unfortunate achievement gap, household or home ownership gap. Our trajectory is to widen the Black-white disparity, and the trajectory of Black wealth is on a decline now. We haven't recovered yet from the housing crisis, and now we have been devastated by COVID. So to delay is not something that the majority of the community supports. This is a new movement that has been convened from their political campaigns. And I hope that they would use the great effort that they've put into dismantling this initial goal to join us in improving the work. As I agree with Sebastian, what we need to do is expand the fund. Right now we have a $10 million commitment. Thank you to the residents and businesses and faith-based organizations, including St. Nicholas Catholic Church and JRC Synagogue in Evanston and other businesses like Temperance that have responded with actions like building the fund. Thank you to academics in our own city and across the nation that have joined us and partnered with us in building some capacity so that we can improve our program and our goals going forward. But not only do those partners validate this as repair and justice reparations, but they also have endorsed it. We have an endorsement by the National African American Reparations Commission from August of 2020, that what we are doing in fact is reparations. And the motto has been inspiring to.
Hello, Alderman.
The motto has been an inspiration to other cities nationwide, and they're following towards repair in line with the actions of their city government. So this is not a one reparation program fits all, but sure, it should be a nudge to other cities and institutions, including universities, following suit after Georgetown and Princeton Seminary and following suit from the Catholic Church that has established reparations. We cannot get to full repair as one single municipality with one initiative. This is gonna have to be a holistic approach from institutions and partners and others that were an accomplice to anti-Black racism and the disparities that we see today.
Professor Alvin Tillery, I wonder about maybe what I heard in Sebastian Knowles's comments is, you know, sort of an older story in among activists, which is, does the small step forward interfere with the goal of the larger, you know, the larger thing, right? Does an incremental improvement in healthcare block the idea of people who want to see government, you know, universal government healthcare, for example? I wonder what you think that, you know, a small step towards a reparations program in one community somehow interferes with the larger goal. Or do you think, no, this is the way it's going to be, step here, step there, until, you know, there's more momentum built up?
So I am not of the view that small steps toward this goal will prevent, you know, sort of greater accomplishments toward the goal. You know, what I want to say is that the politics of opposition to this that are cropping up are pretty normal in cases of reparations, right? Because reparations touches on things that are deeply emotional for people: identity, race, harms, government sort of participation in creating harms. You can't find a perfect reparations program anywhere in American history. You know, and so what people are concerned about is that there are many people who believe they are entitled to have the harms that they've been exposed to on a daily basis, racism, whatever that may be, personal slights because of race, redressed, But you can't do that with a fund of $10 million. It's impossible. And so it seems to me that what's happening in Evanston is, as Alderman Simmons is saying, is one step toward this greater work. And I think that the opponents also need to realize that, as I said earlier, you know, all of this work is contentious. And these programs have to be designed in such a way so that they'll be sustainable. And the reality is, even with $10 million, you can't give every Black person in Evanston a direct cash payment. If you did, it would be a very small payment at that. And so would that be helpful, right? But this kind of politics always crops up in cases of reparations. We think back to Japanese Americans getting reparations in 1988. There were lots of problems with that. They waited until people were very old to give them the reparations. They gave them $20,000 when they should have been giving them about $250,000, right? And so people were saying then, well, this isn't right. It's not morally, you know, what we should be doing or correct. But these are all symbolic acts and tangible economic steps toward, you know, reparation. And so the debate should continue. And as Alderman Simmons said, if there are improvements to be made, they should be made. But I don't believe that one step forward is two steps backward in the broader fight. Now, what I will say is I do think that federal intervention is important here. Cities like Evanston can't do this work on their own. They can't even do the bulk of the work. Harper's Magazine says that if you were to fully calculate what's owed to Black Americans from slavery, it'd be $97 trillion, right? You know, Professor Darity at Duke says it would be 11 trillion. More conservative estimates say 3 trillion. You can't do that with marijuana taxes in Evanston, but you can do something. And it seems to me that that's what is happening in Evanston, and that's what's exciting about it. Is it a perfect program? No, but Alderman Simmons is calling on critics to join her to make it better. And I think that that's the right move.
We are almost out of time for this conversation. I do, Dino Robinson, I want to ask you, we did get some texts from people, and this is something you hear crop up when reparations comes up as a topic. We got a number of texts from our listeners. Steve in Mattoon said he thinks that Southern states should be responsible for reparations. I wonder what your response is. And then we also heard from Sal in Champaign, who just says he doesn't support it. He's white. He did everything in life he achieved by himself with help from no one. So why should someone else get money when he doesn't? I wonder if you can respond to that sentiment that this is a problem for the South and not the North, given what you've researched.
Well, this is a problem across the country. The South is usually targeted for these horrendous crimes, but the North participated as well. The North did have slavery for a while. The North did practice in segregated communities and stripping of wealth in communities. So it's not just a Southern thing. It is a United States issue. And in the other response too about, you know, pulling yourself, that whole concept of pull yourself up by the bootstraps. The federal government has always supported the white population in the United States. And when it relates to housing, there was a, you know, housing program in the 1920s that encouraged white families to participate in that with federally backed funds that Black residents were barred from. So with that simple infrastructure that was set up for them, it put the Black community at a disadvantage. And the gentleman that responded to that is a beneficiary, a generational beneficiary of that that opportunity that the Black residents were not privy to. I do want to follow up on one other thing too. You know, this is regarded to the email or the text message stuff from Sebastian. This housing program, I think there's a hyper focus on just housing. When the actual resolution states, you know, housing is one of three items that we're trying to tackle. The others are economic development and education. And there are groups in Evanston that have been working diligently for the past couple of years on these initiatives, especially education, which is getting some really good headway. It just hasn't come to the forefront yet because we've been so hyper-focused on this first remedy of housing and what that could look like.
And Professor Tillery, I wonder if you also want to weigh in on those common objections. I'm sure you've heard them before about either the sort of bootstraps argument or take it where you will.
Yeah, I mean, you know, most of our public education for people living in the baby boomer and Gen X generations has been grounded in white supremacist ideals of how we got to where we are. What I will say is that Dino is absolutely right. Illinois, the Homestead Act of 1862, the entire point of giving homesteads to white people on the East Coast so that they could move to Illinois and set up farms was to keep newly freed Black slaves from moving into the Midwest. We haven't even gotten to things like the federal segregation of the US military, you know, and the GI Bill, which essentially built the white middle class in America and excluded Blacks. And so, you know, I would ask that listener to dig a little bit deeper into his or her family history and to think about the ways in which, if they were Black, the opportunities that were accrued to their families over generations would not have left them with boots to pull up on any straps. And so that's what I would have your listener do.
Alderman Simmons, I want to ask you, what you mentioned that this is one step. What sort of relief would you like to see from the state, from the federal government when it comes to broader reparations?
Thank you for the question. That's more of what I would love to hear. The state of Illinois, under the leadership of Rep. Will Davis, introduced reparations, I believe it was in the last few months. I would love to see action. I would love to see it come out of a committee and pass through the state with funding. What we're seeing is a lot of reparation initiatives in other cities and states without any funding. So it's ceremonial and aspirational until there is funding behind it. I would love to see HR 40 advance, and I'm encouraged that it currently has more co-sponsors than ever in its history. It has its first ever Senate companion bill introduced by Senator Booker, S-40. And there was just a hearing maybe a few weeks ago and looked to be some action in the coming months, support from the president and vice president as well. So what I would love to see is those bills move forward with funding and with urgency, understanding that incremental steps are going to be necessary, very targeted, but to delay any longer is not in line with what the community at large nationally has stood in solidarity of Black Lives Matter and repair and redress. So I would love to see those bills passed with funding and some immediate action to bring repair that is measurable to the Black community and overdue.
Alderman Robin Rue Simmons is an alderman from Evanston's 5th Ward. We've also been speaking with Dino Robinson, who is a historian and founder of Shorefront Legacy. He prepared a long report documenting the racist and discriminatory housing practices in Evanston dating back to the 1800s. We've also been speaking with Professor Alvin Tillery, director of the Center for the Study of Diversity and Democracy and associate professor of political science at Northwestern University. Thank you all so much for being with us today to talk about this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listeners, before we take a break, I do want to mention today, March 11th, is the one-year anniversary of the World Health Organization declaring COVID-19 a global pandemic. Soon after, Illinois closed schools, restaurants, most other public spaces. We are collecting memories of our pandemic year. Do you remember when you first knew this was going to be an experience unlike any other? What are your pandemic memories? Maybe you just want to remember someone you've lost this year. We want to hear from you. Leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. We might share your comments on air. Coming up, a conversation about astrophysicist George Carruthers. After the break, stay with us.